ending to a really exciting Vikings game yesterday. 34-33, the final score. Just an absolute shootout. The Vikings offense looked great. Two missed kicks ended up being the deciding factor in the game. A missed extra point early in the game, and then, of course, that field goal at the end. The guy made 252-yarders earlier in the game and then misses a 37-yard game winner. What is it with the Vikings and clutch kicks?
I don't know.
I'm convinced. Yeah. I think I made this joke before, but I'm convinced at some point in the future there'll be some study that shows that the color purple messes with your depth perception.
I don't think that's the problem. I'm sure it's a pressure problem.
But it's so, I mean, it's not like Vikings are the only team that it happens to, but it consistently happens with the Vikings.
You get down to the point where like your kick is the game deciding point.
That's your job.
It is their job.
That's your job.
100%. It's their job. Yes. But I think that there's probably something to that mental aspect of, you know, of your kick is what the game depends on. And ideally, with a perfect team, a perfect game, and all of that, it won't come down to one kick. It won't come down to it's just being
correct.
On the kicker's shoulders.
Correct.
So, like, it shouldn't end
it's
up
being
a team
being game, yada, yada. You know, everything else, the win into it, it shouldn't have to come. Yes. We've all heard that. But at the same time, like, the exact same time that was happening, you had another game on the other channel. It was Dallas and the Chargers, I think. Cowboys and Chargers. And that guy nailed a 40-something, 50-ish yard field goal right as time was expiring to win the game for the Cowboys. You know, I mean, so when you sign up to be an NFL kicker, you're signing up to be put in those exact situations,
yes,
knowing that that's going to be your job.
Well, and, the dude has one job,
yep,
and that's to kick the ball.
It's to swing your leg really hard.
Yeah.
That's it.
But again, you know, I don't know. it shouldn't come down to one kick. Unfortunately, it did, and unfortunately, it did not go the way of the Vikings.
Yeah, Vikings started 0-2. Usually on Mondays after Vikings games, we talk with Voice of the Vikings, Paul Allen, in this segment. He was late getting back from Arizona last night, so he's not going to be able to join us. Dalvin Cook had a little ankle sprain. He racked up 148 yards. He had a fantastic game yesterday. I mean, the running the ball up the middle against a much vaunted Cardinal defense, really good Arizona defense, they could not stop Dalvin Cook when he ran up the middle. But he did suffer a little ankle sprain. Hopefully that won't keep him out of action.
Ankle sprains are the worst. I mean,
ankle sprains can linger, especially the high ones.
Yep, I've broken a lot of bones, but when I sprained my ankle, I think it was the most painful.
Yeah.
Compared to any bone that I've broken, spraining my ankle was way more painful.
I had a period of time in my life where it seemed like I couldn't go like 3 or 4 months without rolling my ankle just randomly. You know, just like walking across the living room and it just, whoop, you know, did the quick roll. And it, every single time, man, it was the worst pain. Swells up, think it's going to be broke. Hasn't happened in a long time, fortunately.
The ankle rolling era of Drew's life.
As I'm walking out of here today, I'll probably do it three times between here in the elevator.
Jinxed yourself.
I did. Michael in St. Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I grew up at Met Stadium, and lifetime Viking fan. No, we missed more crucial kicks than any other team, especially like in big games like Anderson and NFC Championship.
Mm-hmm.
This one when Teddy Bridgewater was here playing at the Gopher Stadium, we missed the kick to get into the next
round.
Really,
that position seems to have a little jinx on it, doesn't it?
Yes.
And it's not like we've had bad kickers. You know, I mean, we had some great kickers go through this team. Anderson on that, you know, the NFC Championship game that you referenced. I mean, that guy was having a Hall of Fame season. Hadn't missed a kick in like 17 years or some ridiculous stat going into that game.
Right. Well, even when we picked up Bailey, he was supposed to be one of the most accurate kickers ever as well. From the Cowboys, and same with them, and then Zimmer got rid of him because he's missing kicks. So
you think Zimmer pulls the trigger on this kicker?
I'd say, well, you know, I'm Zimmer and kicker, so good question.
It'll work out real well. All right, man. Good to hear from you, Michael. Thanks for calling in. Want to jump into this editorial here out of the Star Tribune from over the weekend. This was absolutely worth reading, and it was written by Elijah Norris Holiday, who is an independent candidate for the Minneapolis City Council in the 5th Ward. Now, we'll preface this by saying I don't really know much about Elijah Norris Holiday. I have not been paying very close attention to the ward level city council elections. But the headline of the editorial is "To Have Your Eyes Opened, Join a Cop for a Ride Along." And I think that, you know, if you find yourself, you know, very invested in this Yes for Minneapolis, the police defunding, you know, getting rid of the minimum funding requirements for the Minneapolis Police Department, you know, if this is something that's important to you, you know, I would encourage you to do the same thing. You know, schedule a ride along with cops. They're more often than not more than happy to have you come along, and they'll arrange it for you. That's what this guy did. He writes, "I wanted to learn firsthand what it is like to be a Minneapolis cop at this moment on the North Side. So on a recent Friday, I scheduled a ride-along. The officer picked me up at 7 p.m., and I was handed a lawsuit waiver and a bulletproof vest. In that eight-hour shift, we responded to many calls, including shots fired, drug overdoses, noise complaints, domestic abuse, missing person reports, stolen vehicles, burglaries, armed robberies, and information about illegal guns. We began at Merwin's Liquor, in an area known for drug dealing, primarily heroin and crack. To my surprise, the officer knew many people by their first names, and they knew him by his first name. The respect they had for this officer was authentic. He warned them to leave. Many complained that they weren't up to anything, but the officer reminded them that he knew what was happening, so they elected to go elsewhere to continue their hustle. Another surprise was the amount of drug dealing that I witnessed. Broadway and Lindale, 12th and Logan, 12th and Knox, 29th and Oliver, 30th and Oliver, and many other locations. In addition to the active drug dealing, what surprised me was how many people had warrants out for their arrests for drug trafficking, gun charges, domestics, etc. I asked the officer if it was normal for so many people to skip out on court, and he replied, absolutely. So I asked the obvious question, why didn't he just pull up and arrest these individuals? He told me he had chased a fugitive wanted on multiple drug and gun charges at a laundromat earlier in the day, but the man escaped. He could spend his entire shift chasing after one or two people, but then many other calls for help would have to go ignored. He would also need to send backup to make many arrests, and our shift only had 7 squad cars patrolling the entire North Side. Yes, 7 squad cars patrolling a community with 40,000 people and the state's highest crime rates. I saw with my own eyes why we have so many unsolved crimes and poor responses to calls for help. There are not enough police officers on the street. I say it louder and slower so people will get it. There are not enough police officers on the street. Calls go unanswered, crimes go unsolved, and there is no time to build relationships between the police and the community. And another aspect of that he doesn't touch on but needs to be addressed is that when you are understaffed and you don't have the proper number of police officers on the street, there's not enough talk about what the impact of that is and what that does to the police officers who are on the street. When you have overworked and overstretched police officers with a department that already has extremely low morale, when all the political rhetoric surrounding the police department is not about, you know, what a good job they're doing or how can we support them or how can we make their job safer or better or easier. It's how do we get rid of these people? How do we minimize the impact that these people have on our community? How do we replace these people with something else? I mean, think about what that does to the morale of the police officers on the street. If you are out there by yourself on a patrol and you find yourself in a situation where you could take down a bad guy, but you're going to be putting your own life at risk, you don't think that those factors play into the decisions that police officers make consciously or subconsciously? Of course they do. Getting back to this editorial from Elijah Norris Holiday, a candidate for Minneapolis City Council in the 5th Ward. He writes, "I was also surprised by the number of times suspects were not pursued due to new MPD pursuit policies. We got a call that someone had stolen a blue Honda Civic. We spotted it, attempted to pull it over, but it turned down a residential street going about 80 miles an hour. And they had to let it go. I asked the officer what he thought the role of policing was. He said that the job of police is to respond to 911 calls and nothing more. Police don't have time for anything else.
Wow.
That is not a symptom of a healthy city.
No.
When you have a police department who can only devote the time and resources just to answer 911 calls. He writes about another time they were tipped off that someone was dealing heroin and had an illegal firearm. Again, we spotted them, attempted to pull them over, but they took off, ran multiple stoplights, and due to, you know, MPD pursuit policies, had to let them go. The author, Elijah Hollis, writes, I believe we can invest in mental health services, drug addiction services, alternative response teams, and a community-centered public safety approach while maintaining a robust and culturally competent police force. And when it comes to priorities, that's where these decisions are so important. That's where, yes, that's where elections really do matter, because you want to put people on the city council that are going to have the right priorities and are going to fund these departments based on those priorities. And right now, what you've got is a city council that wants to go out there and pat themselves on the back for, you know, forcing businesses to take away their drive-through windows or not allowing metal shutters on the front, but they won't prioritize public safety and put a police force on the streets that would create a city where the businesses might not feel the need to have metal shutters on the front of their establishments. Unfortunately, he writes, the voices of a few have overshadowed the masses' desires. As we discussed in Sam's Top 5 earlier, some polling was done, and it does back up what the author writes here. Most residents want the police. They want police to treat them fairly, and they want police to treat them respectfully, and they want some apparatus to hold the police accountable when they neglect the public trust. But at the end of the day, they want police. They want law and order. They want criminals off their streets. And the only way to do that is with a robust and healthy police force. We don't have that right now. Criminals are getting away just by simply outrunning a cop because they know that the cops can't and won't chase them.
Yeah, during the top five this morning, we talked about this Minnesota poll that was conducted from September 9th through the 13th. And it outlines how city voters are expressing little interest in having a smaller police force in Minneapolis. Of the registered likely voters that were surveyed, 55% said that they don't want to reduce the size of the police force, while 29% do. The rest are undecided. And meanwhile, almost half favor replacing the police department, and 41% oppose. And then in this poll, it points out that 75% of Black voters oppose reducing the police force.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to 51% of white voters that support reducing the police police force.
Because a reduction in the police force isn't going to impact their neighborhoods.
Yep.
They hardly ever see the police already, so what's the big deal if it gets reduced? These are not the areas that are clamoring for more police, that are clamoring to get the criminals out of their neighborhoods. More on that poll here, with the future of public safety and Minneapolis Police Department remaining a key issue for the city, the poll asked for opinions about who Minneapolis voters would trust more to make decisions about the future of MPD. This is out of the Star Tribune. It's a Care 11 NPR Star Tribune poll. 42% of Minneapolis voters trust the city council to make decisions about the future of MPD. And before you go, wow, that's 42% of voters are stupid, that's still, you know, that's less than half.
Yeah.
That is not a ringing endorsement mm-hmm. from Minneapolis voters on the competency or the priorities of the current city council. The mayor only got 40%. Both of those were within the margin of error. So it's really it's pretty even in terms of who they trust more, the mayor or the city council. But neither of them trust them very much. It's still a minority of voters who trust either of them. The remaining 18% were unsure on that one. The city council was narrowly preferred over the mayor by men and women. White voters preferred the council. Black voters narrowly favored the mayor on that question. 651-989-5855 is the phone number. I'm curious what you think, how these elections are going to go down in Minneapolis. We had Amy Koch in for the roundtable on Friday, and we were talking about Mayor Fry and the upcoming elections and the big ballot question on the future of the police department. And she's flat out said that she expects Jacob Fry to get reelected, which the confidence in that surprised me a little bit, but the more I thought about it, the more I agree. I think Fry is looking at a pretty clear path to re-election currently.
Yeah.
A lot can change between now and then.
I think think it's really easy to make fun of him. I think he's kind of sometimes comes across as a bit of a buffoon in mom jeans.
Yeah.
But to his credit, at least, when you look at his stance on issues, the city council stance on issues, the outspoken activist crowd and their stance on these issues, Mayor Fry actually has been the most supportive of police. And I think ultimately...
Of the
groups that I mentioned. Right. Well, yes. It's a low bar.
Right.
Like, let's be clear. Yep. It's still a low bar. Like, we're comparing horrible with more horrible. But he's been the most supportive out of, like, city council, activists, and himself. The most supportive of police in general. Mm-hmm. And so I do actually think that that will resonate with voters when it comes to the mayor's election.
Well, the one question, when I asked Amy, you know, why she was so confident that Mayor Fry would get reelected, and I think it was Jason Flores who was also in, said, can you name any of his opponents?
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a great point. And I think that...
I mean, yeah, I can. But I don't know how many people can. You got the Sheila Nazad, I believe it is, the outright socialist. You've got a
never heard of her.
Yeah,
don't even know her.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing.
Well, and we.
I'm sorry that I introduced her name to your life.
It's okay. I mean, we just being in the position that we are, talking about these issues every day, talking about these people every day, and having more knowledge on it and on these elections. We should know those names, but the general public isn't going to know those names for the most part.
True.
I mean, people know who Mayor Fry is, for good or for bad. He's still the devil that you know. Not that I think he's necessarily a devil. I think he's just kind of a goofball in mom jeans. So he still handles things poorly, but he may handle them better than others.
Well, if you were going to put in front of me Mayor Fry or the rest of the city council,
I'd pick Mayor Fry in a heartbeat.
I would also pick Mayor Fry in an absolute heartbeat over that group of clowns.
I think he's a well-intentioned good guy. I just don't necessarily think that I think when he ran for mayor, I think he was like, oh, I'm going to stand in parade floats and go on zip lines.
I'm going to ride on the back of garbage trucks and shoot fun videos with Melvin Carter.
That
seems to be what he thought being the mayor of Minneapolis would be all about.
And in his defense, nobody could have ever predicted that we would have what we've had over the last 2 years happening in the cities.
Yes, and it made poor Jacob very sad.
It did. It made me very sad.
Nobody likes my fun videos with Melvin Carter anymore. They actually want me to lead and make tough decisions.
Well, and it didn't help that he had Tim Walz throwing him under the bus every opportunity that he possibly could.
Accurate.
I mean, Walz threw him under the bus for so many things, especially during the riots last spring.
Mm-hmm. Yep, no, that's accurate. Jacob Fry has found himself sort of in the middle of the big rift in the DFL on the left side of this state that has gone incredibly underreported with your hardcore progressive activist crowd. You're sort of led at the helm by your Keith Ellisons and Ilhan Omars and Peggy Flanagans. And then you got your more sort of just, let's keep things status quo. We've got it pretty good here in Minnesota. We don't need to rock the boat too much. You got your Tim Walz and Angie Craig kind of crowd. And I think Jacob Fry has found himself more in line with that group, but like you mentioned, they missed no opportunity to throw Jacob Fry under the bus and tried to basically pin all of the horrible leadership and lack of good decision making during the riots on Jacob Fry, and Tim Walz wanted to wash his hands of the whole thing.
He totally did, and I give Fry credit for even wanting to run again. I wouldn't have the stomach for it.
That is a big surprise to me.
I was shocked when we learned that he actually wanted to run again, because if I was him, I wouldn't want to.
I don't know that. But if he's a guy that is looking at the mayor of Minneapolis or that office as a stepping stone, he kind of has to. Because where else do you go right now? I mean, you have to run again right now. You have to try to get that seat again. You're in an off election year. You're not, there's nothing else really opening up and no other opportunities. And I'm not saying that I know for certain that Jacob Fry looks at that office as a stepping stone, but historically, that has been the chatter around most mayors in Minneapolis, that we'll do this for a little while and then we'll elevate ourselves from there. But the problem is Minneapolis is such a dumpster fire that after two terms in that office, everybody hates you. Because the city's run like crap.
if I'm Jacob Fry, even if I'm looking at it from a career politician standpoint and him like wanting to just either, whether it's have it as a stepping stone or keep his gig, whatever, whatever, I just don't know. And maybe it's just because I don't have the mind of someone who would want to run for office, but I just don't know after everything that the city of Minneapolis has been through, the pandemic, mm-hmm. the riots last spring. That's enough for me to want, if I was him, to want to consider a career change.
Yeah.
Like learn to code, well, Jacob Fry.
We, you know, some mutual friends are pretty close with Jacob Fry. And so we hear a few things every now and again. And, you know, when I was talking to one of them and this topic came up of Jacob Fry running for reelection. And the first question he asked him is like, why are you doing this?
Why are you doing this to yourself?
Get out. Go just, you can move to another state. You can do all sorts of things.
You can do anything.
Yeah.
The world is your oyster. Learn to code, Jacob Fry.
651-989-5855. We've got some open phone lines here. Last couple of segments of your Monday edition of Justice and Drew. We're going to do a few quick hits coming up in the next segment. We got an update on that horrible activist show that CBS was putting out. Got an update on AOC's Tax the Rich dress and the immigrant woman of color designer that she was touting so strongly. You can't get mad at me for this dress. It was made by an immigrant.
Pinkies up.
Couple segments left in your Monday edition of Justice and Drew. Welcome back to the program. John, under the weather, not feeling well today. Hopefully he'll be back tomorrow. Meantime, send him a bunch of memes.
Yes.
Send him every one of your J6, Justice for J6 rally memes.
Or just any meme.
That you can find. Yeah, any meme. Just send him any meme. Make him as random as possible so he'll be very confused.
Yes.
When he starts seeing his notifications.
He'll get so confused and he gets so, like, shook when he's confused about what people are sending him.
It's true. It's true. It's true. So, yeah, random memes at John Justice on Twitter. Start filling up his mentions.
Maybe that'll make him feel better. He'll try to piece them all together and make sense of it.
It probably won't make
it. Yeah, it'll probably stress him out.
Maybe don't do that.
Just do it. It would be funny.
651-989-5855. Let's see what Rick in Annandale has to say. Good morning, Rick.
What's up, Rick?
Good morning. Formerly from Minneapolis. He made me flee. So, hey, one thing about Jacob Fry, if anybody remembers, 4 years ago they did a questionnaire. And Jacob Fry in the questionnaire said he wanted to eliminate the police department.
What?
He's come a long way.
Mm-hmm.
If you check back, they did this questionnaire, and he was one of the ones that said, we need to eliminate the police department.
I just defended him.
So, yeah. Hey.
I think he
has come a long way.
I think he has evolved.
I think the Jacob Fry that is in office right now, and thanks for your call, Rick, I appreciate it. The Jacob Fry that is in office right now is very different than the Jacob Fry that was in office pre-George Floyd riots.
Well, it would be
shocking.
I really
do think that transformed him somewhat. And I'm not saying like he's suddenly now a freedom-loving small government. No. I mean, nothing of the sort. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
But I do think that it took his proclivity, you know, his tendency towards pandering towards the loud minority, which is, you know, that's sort of a hallmark of being a DFLer. I do think that has been tempered significantly by the what happened over the course of the last year and a half.
Well, you know, Drew, to quote our dear boss Chad Abbott, you grow through what you go through.
Damn, Sam. It's you.
So I think that it is safe to say that Jacob Fry has grown through a lot.
It's getting deep with Sam here. So mature.
I'm telling you, I didn't make that up, Chad. I got that from Chad.
I know, but it's just coming from you. It carried some weight. I don't know.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But it's true. I mean, how do you not evolve on, especially on something like public safety issues when you have the riots that happened last year? I mean, mm-hmm. Minneapolis was on a global stage and Fry was on a global stage.
Not for
a good reason. And Fry was the face of a lot of it. And I don't necessarily agree with him being fully responsible for all of it. I think that Walls did throw him under the bus, but mm-hmm. he did have to go through that. He did have to be the face of such a crazy, chaotic, tragic several days in the city that he was mayor of. And that was coupled with a pandemic in a major city, too. So how do you not evolve on issues after all of that?
No, I agree. I think he's a very different mayor now than he was then. And like I said earlier, you know, I mean, I probably wouldn't agree with 95% of Jacob Frey's stances on most policy issues, but you're going to put a choice of him or the current city council in front of me as to who should be making decisions when it comes to public safety in the police department. I'm going to take Jacob Frey 10 times out of 10.
Me too.
In that equation.
Me too. I
wish there were better options available, and right now there aren't.
I think he's got terrible fashion sense, but I think he's a good guy.
I mean, I see what you're wearing right now, so you don't have a ton of room to talk.
I'm wearing a cute dress and a cardigan. Get out of here. You're so rude. You're wearing a t-shirt and jeans.
That's true.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Your outfit's fine. My outfit's fine, too.
Yeah, but I'm going to go around criticizing other people's fashion choices.
The dude wears mom jeans.
He does wear mom jeans.
And he, like, rolls them up in weird way. He's not even cuffing them right.
And they're way too high. He wears them way too high.
I'm not going to get after him for the high-waisted part. That's part of what makes the mom jeans is the high-waisted part. I'm just saying, like, dudes shouldn't be wearing mom jeans and then rolling them up like they're some kind of, like, third-grade little kid.
Want to address an email we got during the break from a listener, James. We were talking about the Justice for J6 rally that was kind of a bust, you know, and a lot more law enforcement and undercover cops that show up than actual people that were there to protest or hold the rally. And so, you know, the joke has been calling it the Justice for J6 entrapment rally. Listener James writes in, "Hi, I'm not sure what you mean by this was a fake rally. Leo's might have been there, but it was a real event put on by Look Ahead America. This guy's done a lot of election data analysis. I watched it for about an hour. The speakers I heard were talking about their experience, about someone they personally know that is in jail and how they have been treated. So it was not a fake rally." I know it was not a fake rally. I was being flippant, being a little jokey with it. It was, you know, an actual event that was being put on. But the disproportionate response by law enforcement, Capitol Police, and the FBI, I mean, it's absolutely worth noting. I mean, that it turned in, you know, it went from being what was probably going to be a small rally that was trying to draw attention to the genuinely unfair treatment that a lot of these people that have been arrested have been experiencing. I mean, you got people sitting in solitary confinement for something, you know, crimes that were hard, you know, that we sit here and watch happen in the Twin Cities on an almost weekly basis, and nobody feels compelled to do anything about it. But because it happened in the vicinity of the Capitol, it's suddenly now a much bigger deal. So that's really just, you know, kind of poking fun at that. And the memes are glorious.
They really are.
Yeah, they really are. The 37-year-old fashionista who made waves at the Met Gala with Democrat Socialist AOC last week. The, you know, immigrant woman of color designer that AOC was saying, you know, made her dress. And you can't get mad at it because of those things.
You can get mad at it. It was a horrible dress. It's ugly.
Turns out this woman is a notorious tax deadbeat with unpaid debts dogging her in multiple states, which is just really just delicious.
Especially
the fact that, you know, you're putting a dress on AOC, who wants to tax the hell out of everybody.
Yeah.
And wants to confiscate pretty much all your wages.
Yeah.
But they call it tax the rich, and she puts that on the back of her dress. Meanwhile, she can't be bothered to pay her own taxes.
Well, and there was like a sentiment that was going around on Twitter when this story has been circulating over the weekend. People were basically saying, it's like, well, you know, when you do business with someone, you don't know their whole background. And so how is AOC supposed to know that she's got all of these things going on?
Well,
and it's like,
that's kind of the point.
It's kind of the point.
If you're going to put this dress on and go to the Met Gala
and make a huge social statement,
right? And, you know, you want every camera trained on your backside.
Yeah.
So everybody can see your bloody tax the rich message that looks like it was written in Chick-fil-A font. Then you should probably do your due diligence and make sure that nothing about this whole scenario is going to come out to bite you on that same back end.
And yes. And I mean, most importantly, it's just ironic.
And
it's
funny.
It's funny and ironic. Like, regardless of the fact that she probably should have done her research or at least known the person that she was working with, it's just like, I mean, you just can't make this stuff up.
Designer Aurora James. This was the woman that made the dress for AOC. She called it a powerful message. But she is apparently involved in something called the Cultural Brokerage Agency, an LLC she formed in 2011 to serve as the parent company of her fashion brand, which is today known as Brother Velly's. It's a favorite of people like Beyonce, Rihanna, and Meghan Markle. That company racked up 3 open tax warrants in New York State for failing to withhold income taxes from employees' paychecks totaling $14,000, according to the State Department of Taxation and Finance. The debts, which were incurred before the pandemic, stem from 2018 and 2019. The company has been hit with 15 warrants in total since 2015. And the company got into a deeper hole with the feds. Between April 2018 and April 2019, the IRS placed 6 federal liens on Cultural Brokerage Agency totaling $103,000. The liens specifically cite the company's failure to remit employee payroll taxes. But Aurora James, though, she has a home in California. Nice home out there in California.
Nice.
But she owes about $2,500 in property taxes.
How many people get away with this?
On this home. While James apparently has no problem stiffing the tax man, she isn't shy about taking money from taxpayers. Her company received over $41,000 in pandemic relief aid. And how much of that was spent to cover AOC's backside?
Not a lot, because the dress looks super cheap. I'm not even sorry saying that, regardless of the font. I'm like, goodness, you could have just gotten fabric and just wrapped it around her.
Oh, and this woman of color immigrant designer that AOC was elevating and touting at the Met Gala. Ex-employees blasted her operation, called it a sweatshop.
Oh, okay. AOC, come on. Come on. Of all the designers you're going to work with, you're going to work with the one that is being accused of having sweatshop-like conditions in their business?
One former contract employee told the New York Post, "I experienced a lot of harassment when I worked for her. Aurora would ask me to do things that were not in anyone's job description, like scheduling her gynecological appointments."
Aurora, get a personal assistant for that, you fool.
It's not appropriate.
If their position was personal assistant,
if their position was gynecological scheduler, sure, then that would be part that would fall under those duties.
No, I mean, I don't think that nobody needs a full-time position for that.
You don't know that. I don't know what goes on down there.
As the woman here, I will tell you, you don't need a full-time position for that, but maybe a personal assistant. But this person wasn't a personal assistant.
The work environment was so hostile, I was afraid to ask for my check. That employee was ultimately terminated.
Man, I wonder if they even got their check.
I wonder if anybody's going to ask AOC about this. Like, is she going to answer any questions about this tax deadbeat slumlord sweatshop owner that designed her Met Gala dress?
Why would she? Like, why would she go out and respond to this when it's so easy for any Democrat to just ignore something and then it goes away?
AOC called her a working class designer. This is a working class woman of color, immigrant from, like, Ontario. And, like, she came from, you know, some war-ravaged country seeking asylum. She was an immigrant from Ontario, for Christ's sake. And get an Uber and immigrate into America from Ontario. But Ames, she's a working class designer, except that she just scooped up a $1.6 million residence in Los Angeles back in September, all while she was collecting over $41,000 in pandemic relief aid.
Wow.
Oh, and
does she even have good credit? How does she do that?
She just bought this $1.6 million residence in September, and it's already listed as delinquent by the Los Angeles County Assessor's Office, saying they owe $2,500 in back property taxes.
Oh, my gosh.
Can't write it. It's beautiful.
This is insane. This is insanity.
It's great. It's wonderful. 651-989-5855.
She frequently jets off to exclusive locations. Her Instagram richly decorated with photos from Jamaica, Morocco, France, Indonesia, Mexico, Italy, the United Kingdom, the Hamptons. During a pandemic.
During a pandemic.
Aurora.
Did she even wear a mask?
Oh. She also found money to make a $2,700 donation to Hillary Clinton in 2016.
AOC, who has made a career out of demanding better worker wages and benefits and taxing the rich to pay for her budget-busting federal programs, did not respond to multiple requests for comment on this story.
Of course not!
Out of the New York Post. Good job. Good job. Great story.
Just can't make it up.
651-989-5855. Final segment of your Monday edition of Justice and Drew right after this. Final segment, Monday edition, Justice and Drew. John under the weather. Hopefully he'll be back tomorrow. Send him your well wishes in the form of random unexplained memes on Twitter.
Yes.
And Delicious. Tag him at John Justice.
Do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just confuse him.
I'll have to answer a phone call later. Like, what's going on?
Like, is there something happening? Is there news that I didn't hear about?
Why are people sending me all these weird pictures?
What does it mean? Sorry, John.
I don't know if anybody watched the Emmys last night. I mentioned earlier I watched like 15 minutes of it. It was all I could bear.
It's trash.
But already the backlash is starting. So, you know, you remember like Oscar so white, Emmy so white. Like when not enough people of color get nominated. Right.
Yep.
You know, people get mad. Well, that wasn't the lack of nominations wasn't the issue last night. But there's already stories out there about how not enough people of color won.
Yep. Yeah. Well, the issue is they didn't win the major actor awards.
Right.
Because there were people of color that won things for like writing and everything. There were awards that were won for that, but they didn't get the major actor award, so they were snubbed, and clearly it's systemic racism.
Right. That's the only possible reason that it could be.
It's not that the person who did win actually just deserved it.
No, that's never the case.
No.
That's never the case when it's not a person of color that wins. It's always a snub.
Yep. They're just racist.
This is what happens when you start tallying and keeping track of everything based on race and skin color and things like that, is you're going to be like, well, hold on. There were six of this color, but only four of that color and eight of this color. What does that mean? It means nothing. It means that some people voted on some awards and those were the people who got the most votes. That's all it means. But it doesn't stop people. Also, nobody was wearing masks last night
at the Emmys. Of course not.
You know, only the poor plebes have to hide their faces. The beautiful people do not have to hide their faces in our brave new world. So this was getting some traction on social media last night. Hollywood celebrities went maskless at the 73rd annual Emmy Awards as millions of children are being forced to wear masks in school. Presenter Seth Rogen appeared baffled by the indoor setting as Emmy organizers had announced earlier that the show would take place in an air-conditioned tent. The venue, as shown on TV, appeared to be fully closed. Host Cedric the Entertainer, he should just call himself Cedric.
Yeah, why doesn't he just go by Cedric?
Because he's not entertaining. Cedric the guy.
Like, there's nobody else of note that it has the name Cedric, right? Like, there's no public figure that comes to mind when you think Cedric.
So yeah, no.
He should just own it, and he should be like, Cher. Cedric.
Cedric the kind of funny guy. That's what he should be. Just like Cedric the mildly amusing fellow.
Well, I wonder at what point in his career he decided to go by Cedric the Entertainer. Because it's not like you're running around being like, I'm Drew, the radio host.
The sight of maskless celebrities socializing in close proximity indoors provoked social media outrage, with some noting that children across the country are being forced to wear masks in schools despite millions being vaccinated, and that masks in schools have been shown to do absolutely nothing to protect people. New York Times Magazine reporter Nicole Hannah-Jones, who authored the 1619 Project, has been named to Time's list of the 100 most influential people in 2021. According to Time's announcement regarding Hannah-Jones' selection, American film director Barry Jenkins said Hannah-Jones is larger than life and called the 1619 Project as Nicole's greatest lie. I mean, work. It is a lie. The 1619 Project is a long-form collaboration that seeks to reframe the country's history by bringing slavery and racism to the forefront of the national narrative. It was led by Hannah Jones, roundly debunked by actual historians over and over and over, but that did not stop her from winning a Pulitzer Prize for commentary last year for the project, nor has it stopped a bunch of school districts and leftist teachers' unions from incorporating the 1619 Project bunk into their curriculums. Got a piece of audio here from here in Minnesota regarding CRT and critical race theory that I want everyone to hear. Minnesota mom recently told her local school board that critical race theory teaches her black children, quote, that they will never be able to make it. Here, listen to this.
I have three boys, two in Roseville schools. One of my kids with special needs is in a different school. My friends from the Exodus Movement are here to support me at theexodusmn.org. I started a group called Roseville United, and there's a lot of us here tonight. I'm here to ask the district to stop promoting critical race theory and Black Lives Matter. People who support CRT, say people like me and people who are against CRT are racist. That's their only defense. Yet CRT is racist. It tells kids of color like my children that they will never be able to make it, and white kids that they are inherently racist. When I was a little kid, I had reoccurring dreams about the KKK when I was 7 years old. And now people who look like this are being told they're racist in this school. And it is absolutely appalling. And you might say, I've heard people say, we don't have CRT. We do have CRT in this school. I see it every day. My kid said they're already started with it. He's already miserable about having to start school. Last year, you gave my kid an assignment to read an article out of Scholastica Kids entitled Making Our Voices Heard that told him he would face racism in every facet of his life, from education to the workplace to healthcare. He showed me this article because he found it very discouraging. In the middle school, after George Floyd's killing, they sent out an email and they actually segregated kids by race to talk about it. In the email, it said, we will have a group for whites, for blacks, for Asians, for Hispanics. I couldn't even believe it that we're going back to segregation after all we fought for. In middle school, you segregated kids of color by having the kids of color stand up and the white kids stay down, and you offered kids of color $10 to give away all their personal, private, disciplinary information to an outside organization. And I've also heard from teachers here that you have a policy, like Minneapolis, that discourages teachers from teaching, from disciplining kids of color, because the, as the Isaiah group says, disciplining kids of color is a pipeline to prison. Well, I have to tell you something. Not disciplining them is the pipeline to prison.
Yes.
Telling them they don't have to be accountable. That the same as animals. They're not like white people who can behave. We have lesser standards. We don't think they're truly equal. I don't think you think we're equal. And it's appalling to me. Systematic racism does not exist. We used to have systematic racism. It was called slavery and segregation, and we fought alongside each other to end it. It doesn't exist. BLM said they're fighting for the liberty, the liberation of black people. We are free. Breaking news, we are free. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last. This movement makes black people look delusional. It blames white people for all our problems when everybody knows they're not. Our successes belong to us, as do our challenges. And the wonderful thing is, we can do better for ourselves. We don't have to sit around and wait for some white savior to come around and help us. And I wish Roseville schools gave that message. It seems like, I don't think you will, though, because you guys love it. You white people love it. You need black people to be victims, to cleanse yourselves of your unjustified white guilt. Damn. Well, do it some other way. Get a friend. Get Damn. A therapist. Don't use my kids. In conclusion, I hope you find... Can I just say my last sentence? In conclusion, I hope you... I hope my kids find your racist messages unbelievable, because they see me, their mom, who was raised by a drug addict and suffered abuse as a child, become a lawyer. If I was inundated with these ideas, I don't know where I'd be today.
Everybody needs to hear that audio. That
what
was
a powerful, powerful statement.
That was Kofi Monska, who we've actually had on the show. She's called into the show before, an attorney, a mother of three children. She was urging the Roseville Area School Board to stop promoting critical race theory and Black Lives Matter in the classroom. I wish her words would not fall on deaf ears, but we've all seen these school boards around here. We've all seen the impact of groups like Education Minnesota. They are dead set, and they are completely intent on continuing to infect kids' minds with this awful, awful garbage critical race theory. And, you know, you can have a million moms come up there and say the same thing that Kofi said to them. And I'm afraid that it wouldn't really make a whole lot of difference. Let's go to the phones. We got a few minutes left. 651-989-5855. Joe in Minneapolis. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, guys. Hey, one of the big problems that doesn't get talked about enough or done anything done about is what this woman has to put up with when she goes to this meeting. She's not allowed to mention names. She talks to the problem, which is, quote-unquote, the school board, much like the FBI is the problem. The people that are doing this are in those organizations, and they get to be protected. They get some kind of status where they don't get to be named, and it's a silencing thing that the left uses, and I think it's time that it stops because there are people that are involved in every one of these decisions, yet the people are being silenced like this woman. She's not allowed to say the names of people that are doing these things.
Yeah, that's a great point, Joe. I appreciate your call. That's the whole point of having these layers of bureaucracy is to remove accountability from individuals making individual decisions. So when they talk about things like systemic racism or institutional racism, that's a bunch of BS. All that it does is it takes away any sort of accountability on the people that are making decisions. If you find that there is racism within your kid's school, if you find that there are people and administrators or teachers or whomever within your school that are making decisions that are causing undue and undeserved harm to children of color, and they're doing it for purely racist reasons, then fire them. Every bit of racism is perpetrated by an individual onto another individual. If you have systemic racism in your school, that means that you have a bunch of racists working there, and you can fire them, name them, and fire them, and get them the hell out of there. This is not a problem that we don't know how to fix. We've dealt with this in this country for a very long time. But when you start, you know, using things like institutional and systemic, what you're doing is you're saying, no, this isn't a problem that can be fixed by electing better people into public office. This isn't a problem that can be fixed by replacing bad apples. No, no, no. This is much deeper. We need to dismantle all of these institutions in order to fix this problem, which is what they want when they talk about systemic racism.
People and entities that say things like systemic racism are so good at just not taking accountability for themselves and for their own mistakes and for the mistakes of the people that are in those positions. Mm-hmm. It's just such a good way to just be like, oh, nope, this is just an overall issue. Right. This isn't an us issue.
No, it's an institutional issue. Meanwhile, you know, the look, elections matter, right? I mean, you know, you've had an area and a school board area that's been run by the left now for generations, and we're seeing the results. You've got one of the biggest achievement gaps between students of color and white students in the entire country. Hashtag vote DFL, you know, just voted harder. Yep. Meanwhile, Minnesota High School, according to the Minnesota Reformer, has switched to virtual learning and moved some classes off-site because of safety concerns after an homeless encampment sprung up on school property.
It's on the property.
Volunteers of America High School, an alternative school of about 85 students near the intersection of East Franklin and Cedar, will continue holding virtual and off-site classes until they are, quote, assured of the physical and emotional safety of both students and the staff. For many months, we've been reaching out to law enforcement, city, county, and state officials, as well as our community partners in the neighborhood, sharing information and making them aware of the needs of our student and staff. While we are frustrated by the increasing violence and lawlessness around our school building, we remain hopeful for a shared solution. Good luck.
Unfortunately, I mean, when we were talking about the story earlier, when you had the city council candidate who was doing a ride along with a police officer, and that police officer admitted that they really are only responding to direct 911 calls. Mm-hmm. They just don't have the staffing to deal with an issue like this.
Nope.
Unless it's a direct emergency in that very exact moment.
Correct.
They don't have the resources to be able to go and disperse an encampment like that right now.
No, and encampments have been essentially normalized. I mean, how many years now have we been talking about this encampment popping up here and this encampment popping up there? I remember when there was one and it was a big deal and nobody could figure out what to do about it. And they were going out, and it turns out that the people that were, you know, fighting to keep the police from removing the encampment were also selling drugs to the people in the encampment. So that was awesome. So, that, yeah, these encampments in the parks have been normalized now.
Yeah.
And you've got a group of very active, very loud leftists out there that want to essentially codify these into permanent encampments.
Which is just so ridiculous. And now it's impacting the school.
Yep. Now these kids can't go to school because of a dangerous, drug-infested homeless encampment on school property. There's your Minneapolis leadership. Sam.
Yes.
What'd you learn today?
Well, other than about this encampment that's on the school. And I learned about that. Around 6:40 this morning, I learned that the U.S. has admitted that they accidentally killed 10 civilians in a drone strike in Afghanistan, even though at first they hailed that drone strike as a success. At 7 a.m., our D.C. correspondent Andrew Langer came on the show. I learned his thoughts on the dud of a J6 rally this weekend. It was pretty much all made up, all for nothing. At 8:20 this morning, I learned about how AOC's Met Gala dress designer doesn't like to pay her taxes or treat her employees well.
Or pay rent. Or pay mortgages.
Yep, any of that. How ironic. If you miss any of those conversations and you want to catch up on the show, just find our podcast on the iHeartRadio app by searching for Justice and Drew.
Hopefully John will be feeling better and will be back with us tomorrow. We will also talk with Pete Hegseth from Fox News tomorrow. Have a great day, everybody. Be safe. We're back tomorrow, 6 to 9.